Hey, I'm Melissa McHugh McGrath.
Melissa is this amazing dog trainer, podcaster, and author in Somerville, Massachusetts.
I train humans so their dogs are happy and well-behaved.
And I'm Sip Sipperstein.
Sip is a dragon veterinarian in Oakland, California.
Yep, I'm a doctor for bearded dragons and bunnies and birds and other critters.
And you've just landed in Totally Possum,
an animal podcast for adults.
Each episode, Sip and I will use our combined expertise to share amazing animal stories, give you an inside peek into our professions, go deep-ish into animals in the news, and maybe even reveal some tips that you will be glad to know if you have pets at home.
A stew of the practical and the just plain silly.
It's a Zootopia party, and we're determined to have some fun. We are not going to watch our language.
We're letting our hair down.
You just don't know what we might say, so cover your children's ears. You've been warned. Unless your kids are cool with massive piles of kinky cicada sex, magical raccoon dog testicles, and occasional swearing.
It's your call, folks. Melissa, it's time.
Souffle time?
Souffle time. Chocolate cake time.
Always time for souffle.
It's time to announce our t-shirt winners.
What? We have what? More than one. Oh my God, at least two other people listen to this shittery.
We are ready to announce our t-shirt winners. The requirement was that you needed to either submit a story idea that we use on the show. No one did that. And or or send us a review that you put in for us. Mm-hmm. Or fan art. And that got interesting because fan art ended up having a very broad interpretation, which was super cool.
It was actually pretty great. Art is in the eye of the beholder. And
exactly.
The recipient.
And I think there's no question that Dr. Vo sent us outstanding fan art.
Girls but, talented.
But then we announced the contest after that. So Dr. Vo will get something else special. And if anyone forgot, the fan art that she sent was the cicada.
The sex craze cicada in dominatrix gear.
In dominatrix gear.
It's amazing.
Which was amazing. And then we announced the contest. So we'll do something else for Dr. Vo. So, Melissa, do you want to do the first one?
I'll do the first one. I'll do the iTunes review.
Excellent.
So we got a 5-star review from Annika. Okay, so Annika MG1 wrote, amazing. This podcast was hilarious and still informative. I am going to add some editorializing here. I don't think we're that informative. Keep them coming, ladies.
Eye of the beholder. Eye of the beholder.
It's artistic. So yeah, this podcast was hilarious and still informative. Keep them coming, ladies. Can't wait for the next episode. That was from Annika. Thank you so much. Yay, it makes us happy. And you get a t-shirt. And we don't have a t-shirt cannon that goes that far. So we'll send like a carrier pigeon or something. You will get it.
The next winner we actually mentioned in the last podcast. And he is a winner. This is Gerald from Edinburgh, Scotland.
Gerald!
Thank you for listening from Scotland, Gerald. I understand that Gerald is walking around Edinburgh with physical leaflets about our our podcast.
Oh my God, is Gerald our first groupie?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
He's our first analog-ish groupie. So Gerald wrote a poem.
Oh, I can't wait to hear this.
Here we go. The canine growled at mate Albert. Pause before you paw my possum shirt. My paws are power some and hurt. They'll knackle you in dirt without the shirt. Bert spat back. I'll change my tack. Summon rat pack to ride on yon outback. One glorious hack, full pelt, no lack. So keep the shirt until we're back. That possum is a beauty, perfect sack.
Oh my God, somebody call Sir Pat Stew to do a deep reading of that. That was amazing. Sir Ben Kingsley, where are you at?
Unless you are a very, very tiny, tiny man, you may not fit in a shirt, but you're welcome to give it to the small person of your choice.
No, I want to see this man in this shirt.
Okay, all right. Okay.
I want to see this. Yes, and then if we like it, we'll send you another one.
Yeah.
I don't think he should give it away. I think he should find somebody, if it doesn't fit him, to make either a bandana that he can wear around Scotland, or a pillow, a decorative throw
for his home. Absolutely.
Or put it on his dog if he's got a dog.
You know how the kilts have those little sacks in front? The little, little purse sack thing right on the front of the kilt?
Sack.
It could be a totally possum pod, whatever that thing's called. Man crotch purse?
Man crotch purse.
Oh, we're definitely getting hate mail from Scotland.
Oh, God. Man crotch purse. And all of our listeners from Scotland, all one of them, just logged off. Man crotch purse.
And we're out. Okay, we better get to number three.
Oh, my God.
The third winner of the Totally Possum Pod t-shirt is
has
Melissa?
Left the building. The third is Dr. Leaf, who didn't do a formal submission, but I thought her creativity was amazing. I think
it's fan art.
You know what? It was a live science show for one. So she texted, she emailed and was like, hey, can you do FaceTime like right now? I'm like, sure. So I log in and I'm watching her. She is a licensed rehabilitator and she had like 3 week old baby possums who had fallen off of mama. And mama died. But the babies, there were three little babies, and I got to watch her feed these like little naked little possum babies. Here's the dedication that these licensed, I cannot emphasize that enough, licensed rehabilitators do.
Wildlife rehabber.
She had to stimulate their genitalia area to make sure that they peed and pooped by like rubbing a paper towel over it before she could feed them. She has to feed them every 2 to 4 hours. And watching her try to do this, and she's like, I have to do this every 4 hours. And she's a veterinarian. She's a working veterinarian here in Massachusetts in Watertown, Dr. Leaf at Heal Vet. She's amazing. Very, very kind and courteous to every patient that comes through the door. And what she does is she takes these little baby possums with her to work, and they have to stay in a pouch. And then if she's running a little late and she has to feed them, she's like, I'm sorry, client, I'll be right back, and goes and like feeds the babies. And then we'll go back to the appointment. So she's really dedicated to these little babies for the next few months.
I'd just like to point out that the name of her practice is Heal, H-E-A-L.
Isn't it great?
If you've missed like the potential play on words like
Heal. Heal,
Heal. 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 Good possum.
Good possum. But in that like 10-minute video, I learned way more about wildlife rehabilitation and the work that she does and what she has to do. She also like ran a triathlon. And she had to do it under time so she could get back and feed these babies.
Oh, my gosh.
So her dedication to these animals is fantastic. And, you know, props to Dr. Lee for, what do we call this, honorary mention. And she gets a t-shirt as well.
Woohoo! So send us your address, your preferred shirt size.
All two of them. And if we have it still, we will send it to you. And if not, you get the other one.
Thanks for the submissions, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Are you ready for this one, Melissa?
Born ready. What are we talking about?
Dog bites and dog breeds.
Oh, this is going to be great. I'm not laughing at people being bitten by dogs, I promise.
No. A dog bite happens every 75 seconds in the United States. 1,000 people seek emergency care for severe dog bites every day.
Damn.
Each year, 9,500 people are hospitalized for dog bites.
Fuck.
Right? So dogs are just bad, right?
Oh, yeah. Clearly dogs are the problem. Podcast over.
And 80% of severe dog bites in children involve the head and neck.
Yeah.
80%, right? There's a whole bunch of data over the last, well, many years, and then again in the last few years, about breeds more likely to bite people. Hmm. And this data gets broken down in all sorts of ways. It could be what types of breeds tend to bite more, severity of injury, which breeds are more likely to have caused death. I mean, this is serious stuff, right?
Yeah, dog bites are no joke.
And I'm going to be referencing information from some private law firms.
Right.
From the American Veterinary Medical Association. But it's really interesting to see how these different organizations tilt the scale on the significance of the information and what it really means. The most recent data shows in order of most likely breeds to bite. The first group was actually unknown. So what does that mean? Well, the people may not know what breed the dog is. It may be, you know, they just may have never known what breed it is or couldn't report what the breed was. Next was pit bull.
Which we, with a big asterisk, were come, we'll get to it.
Then mixed breed, which could mean pretty much anything. German Shepherd, Terrier, and Rottweiler. So those were our top offenders, quote unquote. So then the question is, you know, there are bites and then there's like bites with a lot of damage, right? So,
right.
You know, a pit bull, a German Shepherd, they're going to have a lot of force in their bite and they can do a lot of damage and they can really injure people and put them in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Other factors in terms of who was more likely to bite, particularly in the unknown or mixed breed groups, was like the pet's weight and head shape. So dogs with a short, wide head who weighed between like 66 and 100 pounds were the most likely to bite. Okay, most likely to bite. Pit bulls were responsible for the highest percentage of reported bites in all the studies.
Reported being the big word here. And
no, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's reported.
With 22.5% of all reported bites being pit bulls. Okay, followed by the mixed breeds, which were 21.2%, German Shepherd, 17.8%. Okay, so which dog breeds are the most dangerous, right? So that's sort of what we're talking about there. So the AVMA, or the American Veterinary Medical Association, they performed an in-depth literature review. And their findings indicate there's no one single breed that stands out as most dangerous.
So, I wish I had a sound effect board because ding, 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 ding. Be ringing a bell.
The breed is not a dependable marker or predictor of dangerous behavior in dogs, okay? So the more reliable indicators include the owner behavior, training, whether the pet's neutered or not, the gender of the dog, dog's location, so urban versus rural.
So I've done a lot of work with, especially with bite stuff, and dog bites involved with a fatality especially are always reported. So like, and I know you're probably going to talk about the reporting here soon, like how they're reported or not reported. But in dog training, I actually do a lot of work with these dogs that end up biting either usually a kid or weirdly mailmen. Those are the two demographics that tend to have the most bites.
Right.
But I have to use a bite scale while I'm assessing dog bites in the home or on to dogs or other animals or to people. But there are some very clear risk factors, including if the dog is known to somebody, especially if it's a kid, because they tend to like hug the dog and dogs aren't huge fans of hugging, believe it or not. Absence of an able-bodied person to be able to intervene. So like if there's just maybe a kid or somebody who's awkward and the dog lunges, that happened to me. I have 28 scars up my right arm from holding it over my throat when I was like a 7-year-old kid. Our family dog took me down and went for my throat, and my 5-year-old brother got me out. Unneutered dogs, not the victim.
Right.
That tends to, that tends to, the unneutered dog tends to be a one of the markers. Lack of a relationship between the victim and the dog. So if the dog is just kind of there, either on the premises or maybe next door, like fence guarding or whatever. Compromised ability of people and the attacking dog to interact appropriately. So let's say a fence or chained up. A dog is kept isolated from social interaction. So not a family dog. So a dog who's maybe tethered outside or maybe kept in a pen or a kennel all the time. And then you send a kid in to go feed them, which is what happened to me.
Mm.
An owner's prior mismanagement of the dog. So maybe abusive training practices or neglect, but not always. Six of the seven red flags. The only one that I didn't remember was if this dog was neutered or not. All of the other mm-hmm. things were mm-hmm. just like, oh, no wonder why I ended up with like a level
Checked
five
all the
of
boxes.
Six. Yeah, there are only six bite levels, Sip. And one of them, like number six is death. Five mm-hmm. is you were just lucky they didn't hit an artery.
Mm.
I have mm-hmm. a level five bite from when I was mm-hmm. seven and still ended up being mm-hmm. a dog trainer.
Yeah, right.
From our family dog who was a husky. And yeah. so like dog bites, especially with kids, is something that I'm really, no, I mean, I don't want to say I'm passionate about it, like, because that doesn't come yeah. across as
woohoo,
woo, dogs bite kids. But like, but really try to study and be as educated as I can about it, because I do right. work with families and this one hits home for me. And
right,
I didn't know you were right. doing this topic until like 6 minutes ago.
Right, right.
It's funny because whenever I get tattoos, like, so I have, I mean, podcast is great medium for showing off body art, but I have my whole upper arm on my right side is a portrait of my beloved dog, Sadie, who passed away a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have been a dog trainer or have actually married my husband if it wasn't for this dog.
Well.
Yeah, she broke loose and invited herself to a party where I got to be like, hey, you're cute.
Hey, my boy.
I love you. He's like, what'd you say? I'm like, nothing. So, yeah, we now have a kid and it's going great. But I have this huge portrait of my dog, Sadie, on my arm. And the artist was like, I think it would look better if it were somewhere else. This is a great area for the portrait. But I think, like, if you have it on your lower arm, I'm like, but I don't want to cover any of the scars from when I was attacked by that dog.
Mm-hmm.
Because I look, whenever I'm working with an aggressive dog, I want to remember what is really on the line if the parents don't know what they're looking for.
Yes.
Because nine times out of ten, they don't. And they really, truly think that they're helping. Mm-hmm. But they're thinking at it like a person instead of like a dog. Mm-hmm. And we are two very different species. And so when you come at an animal or you punish out the growl, now you just basically have a loaded gun without a safety. And, you know, anytime I see a video with like a kid hugging a dog and the dog is like blinking and licking its lip and like looking worried and its ears are back, this is a very tolerant dog in that it hasn't bitten yet. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's very near and dear to my heart, especially since we almost had Captain taken away for it for our landlord thinking he was a pit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my actual line of work.
That said, 81% of dog bites cause no or very minor injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That don't require medical attention.
Wait, so are those ones reported?
Well, they must be because they have a statistic.
But I mean, like, the way that reporting works is kind of nebulous. Like, there are certain, like, visits to a hospital where it's, like, a mandatory reporting situation. And then there are the people who are just like, it was a nick, it's fine. And then you don't seek medical attention.
I believe one thing is hospitalizations. And another thing is just, have you ever been bitten by a dog? Have you, you know, like that
like
kind
a survey.
Of data collection.
Yeah.
But, yeah, right. And in this case, I can't see that there's a footnote on that particular statistic.
Yeah.
I think that brings up a really important point because these statistics are fraught with missing information, right? So when we talk about percent dog bites, what were the circumstances under which that happened? You know, when we say that pit bulls are the major, major guilty party, what does that mean? Let me throw in some different statistics and then we'll circle back to the what does it mean to say that these particular breeds, pit bulls, German shepherds, why are they the ones who get all the attention?
Because they were the guard dogs in all of the 80s movies that we saw.
Right, exactly.
Also, well, racism, but we'll get to it.
Yeah, right. I think we've made the point pretty well that, yes, dogs can do damage and they can potentially be dangerous.
Correct.
Children ages 0 to 2 made up 26% of fatalities. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, toddlers move funny and older people can also like be shaky or not walk in a more smooth way in a lot of ways. So like that kind of weird gait and
that can be a trigger.
Yes, mm-hmm. that lack of muscle fluidity can be a huge trigger for dogs, especially if they're like, that's not right. Make it stop. I'm uncomfortable with the way that you're moving at me or towards me or shaking or whatever. Like little kids, when they kind of toddle, they walk like a weeble.
Right.
And then they fall over. Like the lack of muscle control is a huge trigger for dogs.
And that doesn't make it okay if a dog bites. But it's something to keep in mind in terms of trying to avoid situations, which we'll get to.
Yes.
So the American Veterinary Medical Association, they did an in-depth literature review to analyze dog bites and serious injuries. And what they found is that there's not a single breed that stands out as most dangerous. Mm-hmm. So really, there are other factors that play into these statistics. The owner's behavior, how do they treat the dog? Mm-hmm. What was the dog brought into the household or chained to a tree in the backyard for?
Right.
Training, the sex of the pet, whether it's neutered or not. So, and then whether these pets are living in urban environments or rural environments, which could speak to some extent about, you know, what sort of stressors the pet is under, but also what what the pet was intended for.
Yeah. Also, like, access, right? So if it's a rural dog, the likelihood that they're just kind of roaming a property line is higher. Mm-hmm. Whereas in an mm-hmm. urban environment, the dog is probably contained, but there's more people. So if you have a mailman coming up, the mailman is more likely to be bitten if the dog breaks through a window or hops a fence. Whereas out in the country, there are fewer triggers, but the triggers that happen, the dog mm-hmm. has more freedom and is able to do some more damage.
Right, right. And then if they are living in an urban environment, so certain high-risk neighborhoods, animals are more likely to be owned for the purpose of dogfighting or criminal or violent acts. And pit bulls have certainly become the poster child for, I'm going to use you because I think you look mean and I'm going to use you to fight or I'm going to use you to be aggressive to other people.
There's an amazing book by Bronwyn Dickey called Pitbull, Battle for an American Icon. And she actually talks a lot about exactly this idea of certain communities having pit bulls and that these dogs used to be like the nanny dog. They were the dogs that you saw in like, Little Rascals with like the, what was the name of that dog? Was it Petey? Was that the dog or was that one of the kids?
No, I think Petey was the dog.
Petey's the dog. So Petey, I hope, we'll get letters. But Petey was like a nanny dog. And like a lot of dogs were like trained to be with like little kids. And Petey's are awesome. But then as soon as these dogs started to be owned by more and more people of color, then like the media perception of these dogs have totally changed and have done a 180, especially with the idea of these like pit bull rings and dog fighting and things like that. So then like the whole idea of like these dogs are vicious being tied into the racism of the people who own these dogs or who are mm-hmm. who are kind of more tied to the messaging of these dogs is actually pretty clear once you like follow the lines. And Bronwyn Dickey does an amazing job of showing that is a big piece of our, like the way that the media covers it has a very, the language that is used and the way that the media portrays it tends to have a very racist-y tone, which is awesome. That was sarcasm. Sarcasm.
Yeah.
Sarcasm. But it's true. And you see that with like German Shepherds of the 80s, Dobermans of the 80s, Rottweilers of the 90s. As soon as black people get these dogs, now they're a problem. And that, right. And you can trace that line all the way back through with every dog that has ever been considered vicious or mean.
Mm. Wow. Interesting. Yeah. When it really comes down to it, the impression is that these big, boxy-headed dogs are more likely to bite, which is what the statistics say. But reading between the lines, I mean, certainly the fact is that smaller breeds are not less likely to bite. And I'll have my own editorial on that in a moment.
I bet.
You're going to get more reports on animals that are scarier psychologically, who can do more damage because they have that bite force. And that those are the animals that are going to get the reputation.
Yes.
Again, a big dog that can do more damage can do more damage.
1,000%. The root cause of the bite is still stress. And a little chihuahua who is stressed, who is snapping and snarling at people, is just as stressed out as a pit or a Doberman or a husky or a vicious golden retriever or a red Irish setter. Whatever dog of choice that you are imagining in your head, those dogs are just as stressed. A bite is just an indicator of stress. And those little chihuahuas are just as capable of being stressed out, even more so. But we tend to put them up on YouTube and laugh at them because it's cute. It's funny. But if that was a larger dog, we would take it more seriously.
And the truth is that small dogs can do damage.
They can do a ton of damage.
They can really hurt and they can be really scary. Bites generally were in the home, but weren't necessarily a family pet. And that police dogs actually are part of this statistic. For example, in Indianapolis, that the police dogs had a higher incidence of biting. And these might be unarmed and nonviolent people. Now, what's going on there? Is it the way they're being handled by the police? So there's just so much subtlety and so many asterisks and footnotes to all this data.
Yeah.
Certainly, teasing a dog can be a top reason why people get bitten, often by kids grabbing the dog's tail, ears, whatever. When I was a kid, we had this Weimaraner. And I will tell you, there's a dog I don't personally particularly trust, but there are stories of me learning to walk and grabbing the dog's ears and pulling myself up by the dog's ears before a parent could rush and stop me. And this dog was atypical for the breed and basically would go, I'm just going to stand really still till it's over. It doesn't feel good. It hurts. I'm going to stand really still till it's over. And then I'd find a ledge of a window and move along. And like the parents running in going, no, don't pull on the dog's ear.
Yeah.
And the dog goes, okay, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And that dog was in all rights to bite my face off, you know. And we were really lucky that that dog was incredibly tolerant.
Yes. I'm so glad you still have your face.
I know. I
love your face. Worth. I'm glad you still have it.
Thank you. And I'm guessing you probably know this one, but 87.4% of pit bulls pass the American temperament test.
So I'm the co-training director of the oldest AKC obedience club in the United States. And one of the things that we often see are people bringing their, quote, pit bulls, and I'll define the quote in a minute, but they're dogs that are perceived as pit bulls by the general public because pit bulls aren't a thing. It's not a breed. It's a it's an umbrella term for dogs who have a blockier head, as I usually say, a quarter of an inch thicker than a golden doodle's. But for the most part, the owners have these dogs that somebody's like, oh, is that a pit bull? Almost like it's like hushed tones. And those are the dogs that are discriminated against in homeowners insurance policies, and there are several homeowners insurance policies that will allow you to get your home insured only if you pass a canine good citizen test. And that clause against BSL, breed specific legislation, as I have a hashtag, BSL is BS, because these breed specific legislations really put good families at risk, and most of these dogs are really good. The issue is that the few that have done damage that have been self-reported in hospitals, if you have a dog that comes at you with short coat that's medium build, maybe a little stocky, and bites you, you are going to go to the hospital and say, I was attacked by a pit bull.
Right.
Regardless if you know what that breed is or which isn't a breed. but it's put under this umbrella, which is basically bully breed type dogs. There's mm-hmm. this famous meme that goes around almost every year, and it's got like 12 different dogs on it, like a Swiss Mountain Dog, a Bernese Mountain Dog, a Pitbull, a Jack Russell Terrier, blah, 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 American Pitbull Terrier. Sorry, not Pitbull. American Pitbull Terrier, Staffordshire Terrier, blah, blah, blah. So it'll have like 12 different dogs, and it says, find the Pitbull. And dog mm-hmm. trainers can't get it right. So, and what they're really saying is find the American Pitbull Terrier. But they've got 9 to 12 different dogs on there, and they all have kind of a blockier head. And yes, you're going to say, well, that's a Swissie, that's a Bernese Mountain Dog, that's a mutt, whatever. But then when you get down to the last five, it's like, well, what is it? And we work with dogs every day. And so if we can't, quote, nail it on the dismount in a picture that we're looking at that is showing a dog in still, and we can't get it, if you are a member of the general public and a short-haired dog comes over and attacks you, you're going to go to the hospital and say, I was attacked by a pit bull. Because you don't exactly know the AKC registries in your head.
And what does that even mean once you say that?
Right.
Shit. It doesn't mean anything.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Captain was almost evicted from our apartment when we had, he's, as best as we can guess, half beagle, half pointer, or he might be half beagle, half pit. We don't freaking know. We really do not know. That says, we do know his mama was a beagle because the boo, like there's no doubt there's a hound in there somewhere. But we had a home assessor come into our apartment from our landlord, and they walked into our house without, they didn't know me and my daughter were home, and Captain charged the front door and was jumping like, hey, look, a new person. And the woman just looked at the dog. I leashed him up. I moved him away. I'm like, you're supposed to ring the bell. Like, why are you in my home? And she's like, I'm sorry. I didn't know you guys were going to be here. She went back to my landlord and said, that's a pit bull. And it was like, one, he's not. What does that mean, for starters? And two, we were at serious risk of losing our apartment, of losing our dog, our landlord losing his insurance. And he texted us going, is he a pit? And we're like, no. Like, he came up from New England Brittany Rescue. Like, he's not a pit bull.
Yes, right.
Right. But had that been a golden retriever jumping on her, I guarantee, because the dog was fluffy, would have been fine. But Captain is a medium-sized, short-haired dog with floppy ears. And so, quote, Pitbull. And we could have been in serious trouble.
Right. And here's the thing. Who's going to get reported?
Right.
Right? People are more likely to report what they perceive as a Pitbull.
Ding, ding, ding.
And very unlikely to report that a golden retriever bit anybody.
Yeah.
So the statistics are naturally skewed by
Perception,
tendencies to make assumptions about, you know, in your mind, it's almost forgiven because it was a glossy coated golden retriever, right?
It was cute. He was a stud. Like, whereas like the blocky headed dogs are just like, that's a vicious animal from the jump.
That's a bad dog, right?
Yeah.
Well, I want to mention something else. Coronavirus, since the time of coronavirus and dog bites.
Mm-hmm.
The stats have gone up during this time of dog bites. And they think that there are several reasons. And these would be sort of my gut reaction to my
the dogs are like, guessed. Why the fuck are you home? I need my alone time.
There are more people staying home all day along with their children all day.
Oh,
right?
For sure.
There are more pets in the home because everybody went to the shelter and got a puppy, right? Mm-hmm. Got a dog.
That'll be a future topic for sure.
Right? So all these dogs came home that weren't in homes before. And there's more stress in the household. Everyone was stuck home with the family pet, and the family pet is picking up on all that stress.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk a little bit more in a second about triggers for bites, but just being around a human or humans who are stressed, want to go out,
can't. Dude, we are stressful AF.
Fighting, right?
Yes.
So it comes as no surprise that during a time when everybody was stuck home and there were more dogs in the home, that the bite statistics would increase.
For sure. And especially since, like, people who had kids who were able to work from home, that they were like, great, now's the time to get the family dog. And without having one before, without having experience, without also being able to get help in the home from dog trainers and behavior consultants, or really being able to like get to in to see a vet really in person, one-on-one. A lot of it was either virtual or like in a parking lot, like really far away, at least in our area. Having to really navigate this on your own with just the internet has been really stressful for people and incredibly stressful for dogs. And stress is stress. Dogs don't have hands to say push away. All they have is their teeth.
How about you tackle how to protect yourself from dog bites? What are the basics of...
Get a cat.
Then you can get bitten and scratched by your cat instead.
So a couple things. One, no stress signals in your dog. That is for sure the number one thing that you can do. And when we think a dog is stressed, we think of tail tuck. But every time I go into a home and they say that there's been a recent dog bite, especially to a child, they say, well, his tail was wagging just before he bit. Tail wag is not the only indicator. And in fact, if you've ever been on a train, I always use this example because I live in the city. But if you've been in an uncomfortable situation around a lot of people and somebody's just getting a little too close and you don't feel good, as a woman, I find myself kind of with a weird smile, just kind of like, great. I'm
it's
so
all good.
Great. Thanks. It's an appeasement gesture, like, fuck you, go away. I mean you no harm. So dogs will do something similar to that with their eyes. They blink a lot and they lick their lips. And their commissure is that like the point where like the top lip and the bottom lip meet, that like little corner. Like when we smile, that part goes up. In dogs, when they're feeling really nervous, that will pull back. You want to look for the whole body. Is it really wiggly or is it stiff as a fucking board? If it's stiff, move away. If the dog has its head turned away from you and is looking at you with their eyes so you see a lot of white, we call that whale eye or crescent moon eye. If you see that, that's a warning from the dog saying, please move away. And especially if that tail starts to move really slow, like a metronome, instead of like that happy, gushy, woo, I'm having a good time. If it's ticking like a time bomb or a metronome, back off and avert your eyes. Don't stare at the dog. We are humans. We tend to, when we're trying to either comfort, oh, I'm your friend. Like we reach for things and we stare. And both of those in dog body language means you want to fight, bro. Like, so don't do that. Avert your eyes and move away. If a dog is growling, for the love of God, do not punish that dog. Let's say a dog has a bone and you got to take it because, you know, you're alpha or some bullshit, which I don't subscribe to. See the other episodes as to why. But if you got to take that bone and the dog growls, don't flip the dog on its back. Don't yell at it. Don't hit it. Don't whatever. That dog is saying, this is mine. Leave me the fuck alone. If I have growled at my daughter when I'm playing a video game on my phone and she goes to take it, what are you doing? That is all a growl is. It means back off, knock it off. It's communication. And there is nothing more beautiful to me than a growling dog, because that means I still have time to work with that dog to build comfort and confidence. There is nothing more dangerous to me than a dog who has had its growl punished out of it. As a dog trainer, we have this thing called the ladder of aggression, which I hate that term because it's really not aggression. It's like the lip lick that I talked about, or the blinking eyes, or the ears are back, or the dog is crouched back, or the tail is tucked. It's all just warning signs that the dog is stressed. And it starts. It's information. It's dog body language. And then when you get to like, of these 11 steps on the ladder, the last three are growl, lunge, bite. 11 is bite. So if you punish out the growl, your dog can only go to bite. And you have no warning. And to me, that growl is a safety on a gun. And there is nothing more dangerous than a dog who doesn't growl. Growling is good, and I thank my lucky stars that I see it more now, which is weird to say as a trainer. But when I see a dog is growling, I'm like, I still have a little wiggle room. I have a lot less wiggle room if the dog isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And working with dangerous dogs who, and I'm not a very big person, I rely on what the dog is telling me and communicating to me through their body.
Right.
So I would 1,000% say learn dog body language. Doggy Language by Lily Chin, I think, is a Bible that every dog owner should get, as well as The Other End of the Leash by Patricia McConnell, which really makes you look at things from the dog's point of view, like why they roll in dead, gross shit, and we bathe ourselves in perfume. And when our dog rolls in gross, dead shit, we turn our head away like, oh, my God, that's disgusting. But if we put on a nice smell and we hold it up to our dog, they do the same thing. So why is it? Why do we perceive these things as different? So it really talks about like how to look at the world through your dog's perspective, including hugging, which I think is mandatory reading for any dog owner. You know, mailmen and kids are the highest levels of statistically children under the age of 8 and mailmen, I think specifically under the age of 4. And mailmen, mail carriers, sorry, mail ladies, mail carriers are statistically the most likely to be bitten by a dog. And usually those dogs are held back by a barrier, don't really have anybody working with the dog through that stressful time of, hey, there's somebody on my porch and I bark and now the mail carrier leaves. Well, hey, I'm a big, tough dog. I made that guy go away. Doesn't realize that he's just doing his job. So that can build stress over time. So really trying to work with mail carriers and kids about how to approach dogs or how to just leave them alone and how to make sure that your dog is safe and managed in those situations with specifically mail people and kids.
So Mace, basically, if you're a 4-year-old mail carrier, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, that is the worst demographic. Seriously.
That's the worst job. Yeah. The gist is that while these statistics are meaningful, they are meaningful in their own way. And when it comes down to it, dog behavior is more predicted by that dog's experience.
Yes.
And whether it's been abused, neglected. When you're around a dog, as Melissa says, you need to be reading the signals. And if the pet seems threatening, like you said, don't make eye contact. Don't encourage rough behavior or attack. And then if you ever come across an animal you think is in trouble, is sick, hurt, those animals may be likely to attack. So you want to, you know, go get help from a professional to assist that animal. Here's my little, you know, editorial or here's my veterinarian's perspective. And I think some of my other vet friends will have the same reaction. And my vet friends who live in and work in inner cities may have a different take on this. But I always make the joke that if I look out in the waiting room and the next patient is either a pit bull or a chihuahua, I'll take the pit bull because the pit bull is going to be really nice and wiggly and sweet. And it's going to be really easy to work with. And the chihuahua is going to take my hand off. And that is not about... And so here I am, you know, stereotyping breeds again, but, and what is a pit bull?
Right.
Stereotyping breeds again, but the little dog is more likely to be stressed. It's a weird situation. It feels more defensive.
They also have no autonomy. We tend to just pick them up and come at them and we think it's cute and we don't help them. Whereas where if it was a larger dog... We tend to be like, oh, wait, this is a serious problem. So it goes back to what I was saying before about stress is stress is stress. But we don't take it seriously until the dog is over 20 pounds as a culture.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so those little dogs don't get the training, the ability to gain confidence, the ability to handle new situations. Mm-hmm. And they are more likely to have trouble, for example, with new situations like going to the vet. At least in the areas where I've worked over the years, the pit bulls that I meet tend to be well-trained, well-socialized, do really well at the vet. And I'm going to still think to myself, that's a big dog with a big jaw. If there were a problem, I could get hurt. I'm going to keep reading the signals.
Right.
But generally speaking, I'm going to have a great experience at dog. And I might get a big lick on the face after the vaccines because the dog like is still having a good time.
Who's a good vet? You're a good vet.
Right.
Hunt us back.
Good vet. You get a biscuit. That if I were going to add an animal to that list, I've got the quote-unquote pit bull, the chihuahua, and the hamster. Definitely still going with the pit bull because the hamster's definitely going to bite me.
Murder hamster.
So,
sharp little teeth.
I would say this about any statistics. Always read between the lines. Always look at the footnotes. Understand what the context is because, as I said at the top, it can sound very scary, the statistics about big dogs, and big dogs, again, can do more damage. But you really got to be thinking about what the context is, what the dog's past experience has been, and I want to hug me a pit bull. Oh, I'm not supposed to hug it. Oops.
No hugging.
No hugging. Wait.
So, like, we have a rule in our house that I think is very important. We can't lay on our animals, but they can lay on us. So, like, there, if we're laying on the couch and they want to curl up on us, that's cool. But we don't go and put our heads on a dog. We don't curl up on the dog. They can solicit that affection if they want. But we've had two other dogs in our house that don't. They're perfectly comfortable on the other side of the couch, and they'll come over and get pets, and then they'll go and lay over on the other side of the couch. But, like, I think that if there are kids in the home, making sure that that is a rule in the home, that, like, wait for the animal to solicit attention from you instead of you going at the animal, no matter what the animal is, because it's not about you. It's about the relationship, and it has to come from the animal first.
And this is quite a good reason why children should be included in some aspect of dog training, because dog training is really human training. As we say at the top, you train people.
I do. Like, that, my whole job is working with people. Like, I feel like I'm a translator between the two species, but I'm really training the people how to look at their dog. I think it's also important to train your four-year-old how to carry a mail carrier bag just in case you need to, like, make some extra bank.
if they want those air barrettes, she's got to go out and do the mail run.
You want more Pokemon cards? Hustle. Somebody's got to get us some health benefits. It's not going to be me. Sit back and let me tell you about drunk seagulls.
What?
So this article...
Now you're just making shit up.
I am definitely not. It's been a rough year for everyone. All those people going back to the beaches being like, it's hot girl summer. They are leaving a lot of shit behind for these seagulls to have a hot seagull summer. So I'm actually just going to read a little bit from this independent article. Seagulls have been spotted vomiting and struggling to walk in straight lines in the southwest of England, leading to animal welfare officers suggesting that they're drunk.
Okay.
So what would, like, a seagull sobriety test look like?
Squawk into this French fry.
Like, just waddle. I mean, like, they kind of walk like they're drunk anyway, so I don't even know how they would tell. But it sounds like the RSPCA has more than, like, at the time of this article being written in early July, the RSPCA had more than a dozen calls regarding drunk birds. And they thought initially it was because they were that there was maybe a local brewery or an alcohol producer in the area that was maybe just leaving things behind. And, I mean, sadly, some of these birds have died and others have been very ill from being found on beaches across Devon, Dorset, and Somerset, which I hear I am probably pronouncing wrong because England.
I think you're darn close.
Maybe. It's like Dorsetshire. No, I don't know. So the RSPCA basically said that these birds have a very similar party girl effect where they just kind of stumble when they're around excessive alcohol. They seem disoriented. They have problems with their balance. They're probably found in a bush. In, like, a Taco Bell drive-thru, just going, I want French fries. Like, whatever.
You're cute.
Like, sexting that guy, like, that they really shouldn't. Yeah. Like, yeah, seagull sexting. But this is my favorite part. The birds absolutely stink of alcohol when we collect them, so now our vans smell like pubs. Oh.
They really are getting drunk.
They're getting hammered.
Oh, no. So how's this happening?
So they've put out a call to, like, get local breweries and distilleries to check that their oasis is being secure. But it turns out that was the first article I came around. But then there was another one that I think might be a little bit more telling and maybe a little... I say it might make a little bit more sense, but it really doesn't. The headline is, "Why You Might See Drunk Seagulls as Flying Ant Day Arrives." I have more questions. Flying Ant Day.
As do I.
As in ants, the animal, not ant, wife to your
aunties
uncle.
And uncles. Yeah,
right?
Okay.
So apparently there are these swarms of flying ants that are emerging from their nests. And it sounds like it's kind of like crazy cicada action. It's also sexually oriented. So Flying Ant Day.
Lucky for us.
That's why it's on this show. It's not come for the drunk seagulls. Come from sexy flying ant time.
Stay for sexy ant flying ants.
Aren't you glad I'm following up vicious bite attacks with, like, flying
yes.
ants? What even is this show? What are we doing?
I don't know.
So Flying Ant Day, I guess, happens every summer. And it sees a young queen ant and their male find each other to mate mid-flight. And the timing can differ depending on where in the country these colonies are. And experts say that weather is the crucial factor in enticing these insects from the comfort of their nest. I mean, girl, same. I'm not leaving unless it's 85 degrees outside and there is a reason to leave.
And there's a sexy ant queen king.
I wonder if it's like the blueberry festival where you crown like those like little Aggie fairs around the states where you have like crown your blueberry queen or watermelon princess or corn dog royalty court or something.
In Wisconsin, isn't it like a cheese bust
it's
or something?
Gotta be
there's
cheese,
a bust
right?
of Miss Wisconsin or and they charge.
Miss Wisconsin, rah, 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 rah,
oh,
rah.
Oh, my God. Listen to you.
Something. I have got the voice of a drunk angel. Okay, so we've got, like, I married a musician, y'all. He doesn't know why. I do. He doesn't. I just got him drunk. So as well as the spectacle of thousands of insects buzzing around the city, Flying Ant Day can lead to bizarre behavior for seagulls, and they have likened it to acting drunk. So these ants are a vital food source for some of these seagulls, including swifts and gulls, and they can be seen feeding frenzied from rising swarms of ants. And so it seems like there's a particular kind of acid which can stupefy these seagulls, which makes them appear drunk, although it doesn't seem to explain why the RSPCA vans smell like alcohol. So it could be that the RSPCA has a pub in their van and they're covering it up with stupefied flying ant seagull drunk behavior, but they're really just getting fresh nickered on Guinness in the back of their van and they need someone to blame. But yeah, so like these seagulls are just like stumbling around these towns in England and it turns out that it's because they think of these flying ants.
So what is the chemical in the ant that's making them drunk?
That is a great question that I have. Accessible. Hold on. Formic acid, which can stupefy the gulls. So let me see if I can find a little bit more. This was according to a biologist of some, I'm guessing a seagullologist. No, that's not it.
Okay.
So Flying Ant Day is when the female ants sprout their wings and venture out of their nest. So I think it's like an ant quinceañera that go out on their nuptial flight.
So they got the frilly dress.
Oh my God. Just like her wings are super glam. According to the Society of Biology, nuptial flight is an important phase in the reproduction of these ant species. And during the flight, virgin queens mate with the males and land to start their new colony.
This is so a Pixar film.
I don't think it is.
And then it's like, instead of the seagull going, mine, the seagull's going, Where are my keys? Where are my keys? Where are my keys?
He's stumbling home from the pub named Ant. What could the name of the flying ant? And it's a pub where, like,
yeah, right.
The seagull's right. Stumbling out of it.
The lazy ant.
Oh God, that's so good. So yeah, so I guess there can be as many as 15,000 of these ants that take flight, and it happens once a year. The males go looking for this hot, nubile flying quinceañera queen. I'm so not a science educator. But the large numbers of these ants, which appear in short spaces of time, increase with the chance of reproduction. There's a high chance that a queen will encounter a male from another nest, which, you know, that's good, right? Like, I know that from biology. Do not with the same nest.
please do not sleep with your brother.
Oh, no. This sounds deeply problematic. Once the male and immature queen have mated... Ooh, I don't like it.
Yeah, no.
That's E. Yeah, so they go, and we're going to ignore the rest of that. And then, yeah, so I guess the seagulls eat them, and then they get drunk. So while it might be unrelated, those frolicking on the beach town should be on guard against crazy seagulls during Flying Ant Day. And I feel like they should have a banner and confetti and maybe like the flying ant queen being crowned or whatever. That's like a 15-year-old girl. Sure. Maybe not a 15-year-old girl. Maybe an 18-year-old girl who can consent.
35-year-old woman.
Yes. Oh, my God. Flying Ant Day should be crowning, like, you know what? Let's go big or go home. 65-year-old woman who just fucking loves seagulls.
There we go.
Yes. They get drunk on feasting on the flying ants. It's their favorite snack, but it can stupefy the gulls. Dr. Rebecca Nesbitt, an entomologist with the Society of Biology, has said that the ants produce a formic acid which can stupefy the seagulls. The amount eaten can explain why the seagulls are not flying away from danger quickly. Like, hey, man, is that a car? Is it? Yeah, it's a car, man. The car stops. Man, we should move. Yeah, and they just like turn and they fly. Not very far into the ground. But yeah, but people were worried about seagull attacks, but it's really more likely that they're going to get hit by cars. So that's what happens there. Although there have been some attacks on people, and I saw a couple of photos on Instagram earlier of these kind of brazen seagulls who I guess should probably go to Seagull Ants Anonymous, that are attacking people because they're just so agitated. And these people have had to be hospitalized because of these aggressive seagulls looking for their sweet, sweet ant hit or a Corona beer or something.
I'm looking for a video. Drunk and disorderly seagulls, almost worth watching to the end.
Almost.
I see some seagulls kind of just yelling at each other.
I mean, it really is just like a bar and selfie, isn't it?
And there's literally a bottle of alcohol in front of them, which is kind of hilarious. Let's see. See, these guys are just brawling. Like, they're not even... Whoa! Okay, they just fell in the water. Oh, no. They're literally brawling, and they fell in the water.
Like I said,
I hope they were okay.
Literally a drunken bar fight in Boston Selfie. 2 a.m. You can't stay here, but you got to go home. And then they go out in the street. They fight. And they fight, and they fight, and they fight, and they fall in the water. It's a normal Tuesday here in Boston.
Just a seagull drunk on the beach. Oh, I've got to wait for the ad. He keeps picking up a piece of bread and, like, dropping it, and he's got a wide base stance to his legs because he's trying to stay upright. And he's like, oh, whoa. Okay, yeah, he's drunk.
He said, I can't find my
towel.
Drunk.
And his piece of bread's just... Oh, he just face-planted in the water. Oh, he just totally face-planted, trying to go for the bread that was like 3 feet away from him because he lost track of it.
I have been there.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. I've been this drunk seagull on a beach, and that's really sad. Yeah, so not all of us have been this seagull, but speaking as one of the hosts on this show who has... 1,000% been this seagull. Been there. It sucks.
No.
That poor seagull is going to have the worst hangover. I fell in the water. Oh my God, seagulls, when they fall off the wagon, they fall into the water. We're at the end of the podcast.
Holy drunk seagulls, where does the time go?
Our music is by Jason Shaw with additional music by Ableton Live.
This week, our thanks go out to the American Veterinary Medical Association, American Animal Hospital Association, ColoradoInjuryLaw.com, and MKPLawGroup.com. Lily Chin's book, Doggy Language, Dunbar Bite Scale, and The Mirror, Independent, and Bristol Post, and the BBC.
You can find more on our show notes or visit our website, totallypossumpod.com, and on our Twitter, @possumpod.
And now all that's left is shameless self-promotion.
I'm a certified professional dog trainer outside of Boston, Massachusetts, the author of Considerations for the City Dog, host of Bewilder Beasts, another podcast for curious folks, but unlike this, it's totally safe for work and all ages. You can find more about me at melissamckeemagrath.com. Now take it sip.
I'm a veterinarian who loves to work with exotic pets in and around Oakland, California, the operator of Zuzu's Puddles Productions, and when I'm not treating guinea pigs, tegus, and pionis parrots, you can find me shaving the mats off my terrier. She's got a lot of mats right now. You can find more about me and about exotic pet care at drsipvet.com. That's drsipvet.com.
You can reach us both at totallypossumpod@gmail.com and send us your topic ideas and questions, or send us bizarre and silly animal stories that might be a little more on the wild side. It doesn't have to be R-rated, but it does.
So that's it. That's the end of the podcast.
Goddamn right. Thanks for listening. I don't know how you got this far. Hug your pets if you've got them.
Unless you have a chihuahua who really, really, really doesn't want to hug. Seriously, don't. And I professionally advise against it. Unless you're already missing your ears.
Respect those opossums, or as we say, stay possum.
Stay possum.
Jesus Christ, we did it.